Thomas Talking Metal Podcast, episode 74.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas. I hope you've had a fantastic week. So, things have been chugging along here at Comics Coffee Metal HQ. Very, very busy with lots of cool things. One of the things is I've been posting some, I guess we'll call them reaction videos on YouTube, checking out some new music and just kind of giving my thoughts. If you're like reaction video averse, just let me preface this by saying I'm not doing like goofy faces or like over-exaggerated expressions or anything like that. And if you dig that, cool, it's fine. But it's basically if you like me talking about music on the podcast and how I approach it there, it's pretty much the same thing, just kind of a feed of that with video. It's been a lot of fun. They're really easy to do. They're real simple to do. And I seem to get some decent amount of engagement from people. And suggestions and all that from there. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Actually, I went and I decided to do a video for a YouTuber who had his band release their first single. And he went and he contacted me afterwards, which was very nice, and he thanked me for checking it out and all that. And in return, he gave me 2 free Bandcamp download codes for his band's EP. Now, this gentleman is known as Chaosware on YouTube. He has a ton of great stuff on his channel with guitar-related stuff. And the band in question is called Corruption. And they have a new EP out. And it's currently out right now. It's a 3-song EP. It is just some killer, thrashy, death metal kind of stuff. And I have 2 free download codes for the first come, first serve, whoever's listening to this. So, all you need to do is just contact me in any way, shape, or form. Short of throwing a rock through my window, just hit me up, tell me you want the download code, and if you're one of the first 2 people to get it, I will send it along with your way, along with the link where to download it. So yeah, it's a very, very cool EP. It's, it's kind of like, if you like thrash and death metal, you're definitely going to like it. And if I could best describe it with an analogy, is like it's just like going to like your favorite like burger place and getting, you know, your favorite burger. It's like you know what it's gonna taste like, but it's still so good. It's kind of like you're having it again for the first time, and that's what this band's EP is like. So it is really, really good. I really, really enjoyed it, and yeah, I'm stoked to share it with you. I want to thank Chaosware for sharing the download codes on that, and yeah, like I said, hit me up, I'll send you the link for all that, and you'll get the debut EP from Corruption, Dead is the Soul, for free. Pretty killer deal. Alright, so let's get on to the recommendations for this week. First up, I have a coffee recommendation, and that is the Toronto Blend from Maple Leaf Coffee Roasters. It's another Illinois-based coffee roaster. I'm sticking local as much as I can within the state. And yeah, I just found them by searching Illinois coffee roasters, and they came up, and they had some interesting blends, so I definitely wanted to check it out. So I got the Toronto blend, which they note as smooth, sweet, with dry chocolate notes. Further information on the website says it features a bright, mildly sweet floral flavor along with smooth, dry, chocolatey finish. Now, I enjoyed this coffee a lot, but I don't think I would, at least in my experience, I wouldn't classify it so much as that. It was very, it tasted almost dark, like a dark roast, which I'm perfectly fine with. But when I first had it, I did a full pot in our drip coffee blender, and I was like, okay, it's good, it's good. It wasn't giving me all the stuff I like to normally get out of certain kinds of coffee. But, you know, as if you listen to the show, I try my coffee different ways. So I went and I decided to try a French press brew of it the other day, and it's like night and day. maybe I got the formulation right. It could be definitely user error here. But when I did the French press version, I made it a little bit stronger, and it really, really, really stuck out to me. It was very, very tasty. It really reminded me of, like, whenever, if you've ever, like, toasted a marshmallow, and it's got a little bit of that char on there, but it's still sweet, and this is with coffee and a little bit of sugar. So it had kind of like that, kind of like a roasty flavor to it, but kind of sweet and smooth, and some of that dry chocolate was really coming through. So when I had it in the French press, I was like, oh, this is some good shit. So yeah, I definitely recommend this. Again, you know, I'm trying it again actually tomorrow morning with the drip coffee maker, playing with the formulation a bit just to see if I can get it right this time. Because if I can get it right, then yeah, this will definitely become a rotating player in our coffee drinking harem, I guess. I don't know. But yeah, Maple Leaf Coffee Roasters. Oh, I do have to mention that they sent the best package, because they sent the coffee, they sent some cool little stickers, but they also sent like this incredibly like awesome dark chocolate bar thing that, like, just, you know, is perfect. It was just absolutely perfect. I was like, oh, nice. I call other coffee makers, hey, pay attention, send a little treat along too, you know, if you can. But yeah, Maple Leaf, they're good people. It definitely sounds like they have a lot of tasty other blends. This was the Toronto blend. I'm looking forward to trying out some more of their other yearly, year-round available blends and all that. But yeah, this is definitely one worth trying. You can find them at MapleLeafRoasters.com. All right, for comic recommendations this week, I actually have a couple Kickstarters I want to recommend everyone go check out. First up is the newest Kickstarter from Fellhound, And We Love You. It's a prequel to the previously reviewed on this show Commander Rao one-shot, and Fel was kind enough to send over a preview to me, and it is just the absolute best work she has ever done. It is super heartfelt, super just full of emotion and violence, and it is everything I said about Commander Rao is probably guaranteed to be this turn to 12 on And We Love You. She launched the Kickstarter a couple days ago, and it hit its funding goal in the first day, which is really, really an impressive feat. So if you want to go check that out, you know, hey, no worries about hitting its goal. It's actually, you know, well over its goal at this point. I think right now it's $1,500 over its intended goal. So yeah, it's a really, really great book. Fell's art has just taken another level on here. And yeah, it's just, I don't want to give away too much, but if you've read Commander Rao, this is like essential reading. If you have not, I highly suggest you go pick up Commander Rao. Or you can also get it in a bundle with this Kickstarter as well. And they're two very, very touching and action-heavy love stories about just... I can't give away too much, just because I want you to go in and check it out. Just if my recommendations mean anything to you, I suggest you go check this out. And if I'm wrong, you never have to listen to me ever again. The second Kickstarter I want to talk about is Drumsticks of Doom. Now, in January, I had John Westhoff and Dan Doherty on talking about Drumsticks of Doom, and their Kickstarter has launched, and it has also hit its goal, and it's still going on, and they're looking forward to some cool stretch goals, which, full disclosure, I will be part of. I am putting forth a song for an EP that will be released with the Kickstarter, and I will be doing a pinup now for the book, so that's going to be a lot of fun. But even if I wasn't involved with it, in fact, in spite of me being involved with it, I'm telling you, definitely check this out. Dan's art is just utterly fantastic on the book. It's probably the best thing John's written yet, and it's just going to be a real fun book about metal and monsters, and yeah, you can't go wrong with Drumsticks of Doom. Now, for both of these Kickstarters, there will be links in the show notes where you can check out the Kickstarter page and get a little bit more info on it. But yeah, please go check these out. I haven't had a ton of time to read new books and all that. I've been trying to keep up to date with stuff coming out and all that. And yeah, I really think these are some Kickstarters you should not miss. And I will follow up by saying that I understand there's a lot of controversy around Kickstarter with their decisions or indecision about using certain blockchain technologies. And I know for a fact these creators were well underway getting these campaigns set up before any of that was a thing that people knew about. So please don't hold that against them. They're both funded, so I don't think a lot of people are. But just bear in that mind, if that's a hurdle for you, I understand. But if you could think about it in the fact that, you know, they put so much work into these campaigns, and to pivot at the last second because of this would have probably been just, you know, a real rock and hard place situation. So I highly recommend you do check it out if you are hesitant about that. But, you know, that's your own decision. I'm not going to say anymore. All right, my music recommendations this week are also going to be a few different items. I'm going to try to get through them as succinctly as I can, but I definitely think you should check out every single one of these. First up is the album Blinded by the Wicked by Haze Maze. You like Sabbathy doom stoner metal, this is for you. This is right up your alley. It is that done to a T. It's great. The songs are great. Lots of tritone riffs that just, you know, it's you know, bread and butter for this type of thing, and I eat it up every time. The standout thing on this album, though, I must say, is the bass tone. The bass guitar sounds so fucking good. when in the right listening scenarios, it hits you in the gut and the chest at the same time. It's just, the bass tone I want for everything. Even if it's not appropriate for the song, I want that bass tone on everything. It is so good. They have a ton of great songs, though. Devil Spawn, Luciferian Rite. It's all great Sabbath-y jams. You can't go wrong with this. Haze Maze, Blinded by the Wicked. I give it 419 out of 420 Blacklight posters. Alright, next up is the album Where Myth Becomes Memory by Rollo Tomasi. This was another band where I was only checking them out simply because the album artwork was kind of unique and interesting, and boy was I glad that sucked me in, because this is an amazingly deep and thoughtful album. It is no stranger to just having big heavy pummeling riffs, but it also has a ton of beautiful melodic passages and just almost ethereal type of stuff. It is very moody. It's very much a vibe album to listen to, and yeah, it was a very pleasant surprise. Stuff like Closer and Cloaked, and the song Trip and Prescience, like it feels like a whole cohesive album. Like, the album in itself is 48 minutes, and it kind of just sucks you in and just weaves you through everything, and it is very, very well done. I guess Rollo Tomasi has been around for a while. I had not heard of them before, but I'm definitely digging into more stuff. So definitely check them out. To give it a rating, let's say 5 out of 5 Sad Boy Headbangs. Just one big forest of delay. Rush, rush, rush. Next up, and the final recommendation this week is Black Light from Beneath the Silence. Now, this band is much more traditionally up my alley. It's female vocals, some good metal going on. If I had to describe them for a point of reference, I would say kind of like a genty Lacuna Coil. So as Lacuna Coil had more of like a hard rock kind of influence, this is definitely more of the gent style metal with those types of vocals and things like that. And just like the Rollo Tomasi album, it really sucks you in, kind of takes you along the ride. It's only 41 minutes, and it's one of those rare albums where I just listened to the whole thing once I put it on, all the way through, and I was like, I wasn't feeling like I had to jump around or check anything else out. It was really, really, really well done. There's some really great tracks in here, like Break You and Wide Awake, and yeah, it's just... It's probably going to be a good mainstay in my working playlist, and I highly recommend you check it out. If you like Lacuna Coil or Evanescence and say, like, you know, I wish their wrists were a little bit chunkier, here you go. Black Lights from Beneath the Silence. I give this one, let's say, 4 out of 5 leather wristbands. It is time to shout out my patrons. These are the fine folks who selected the $3 Chug Life tier on the Comics Coffee Metal Patreon. If you would like your name mentioned on the show, along with access to all the content on the Patreon, along with merchandise discounts, please head over to patreon.com/comicscoffeemetal and select the Chug Life tier. So, let's get to it. Special thank yous to Kevin Mellon and John Westoff. Thank you, gentlemen. And now it is time for my guest, who this week is just a phenomenal talent. I've admired this man's art for quite a few years, and I was so incredibly happy that he was going to come on and talk about his extremely successfully fundraised book, Cancor. I'm sorry if I pronounced it incorrectly. and there's so many questions I want to ask this gentleman about his style, the book, and... just a variety of things. But first, Matthew Ellison, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
You know, I'm going to go with metal to start off with. That's pretty much a daily thing, so I'm always digging metal.
All right. Is it a specific album that you're, like, hooked on right now, or...?
Well, you know, leading up to tonight, I was trying to think, like, well, what can I talk about? And, so what I did was I went through my iPod, because that's where I listen to most of my music, just an old school, like, Generation 7 iPod, I think. Mm-hmm. And I went to my recently played songs and chose the first metal song there, which was Anthrax doing a cover of Avita Zane by Cheap Trick. And I thought that was appropriate because I got into Anthrax because of comic books. I remember, totally. I remember being at the mall. I had just discovered Judge Dredd and Brian Boland, and I go into this little shop that had all heavy metal memorabilia and patches and posters and stuff. This would have been in like 87, I think, is when like Among the Living came out. Mm-hmm. And they had an Among the Living shirt with a Brian Boland Judge Death on the front. And I'd seen the name Anthrax before, but I knew nothing about them. The only thrash band I think I'd even really heard at that time was Megadeth. And I was like, well, I have to buy this shirt. And I wore it to school the next day. There were some metalhead kids in my art class that were questioning me, like, well, do you even know that band? So at the time, I was part of the Columbia House Music Club, and I ordered Among the Living and I'm the Man on cassette. And just immediately fell in love with Anthrax. And in the liner notes for Among the Living, I think either Charlie or Scott is wearing a Dark Knight Returns shirt, which I had. I had the same shirt he had on. So I was just a fan for life at that point.
That's awesome. I didn't realize until I looked at the fundraiser page for your book that you're based in Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I was born and raised in Chicago. I live a bit north of there now, but,
okay.
You know, I still consider, you know, Chicago's still my home. And, you know, Chicago has the guys from Anthrax pop into Chicago a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. And I'm trying to think, you know, you mentioned Anthrax, and like the only like connection to Anthrax I have where it was, I was at the Cincy Comic Con in 2015.
Okay.
The one run by Tony Moore and his wife, Kara, and I remember I was tabling, and I'm just looking around, and I'm like, wait, is that Charlie Benante walking through the aisles?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, shit, I think that's true. And but he was like leaving the building, and I'm like, shit. So I just like, I'm like, you know what? I'm just gonna tweet the guy. I'm like, yeah, hey, yeah. Did I just see you at Cincy Con? He's like, yep. I'm like, all right, cool. Anthrax is one of those bands I never really fully got into.
Sure.
It's like I like the guys. You know, I like a lot of this stuff. It's just they haven't latched on to me. I like some of the later albums that they've done, because I think Joey Belladonna's voice at first was not my cup of tea.
I'm right there with you. It's a strange thing for me to say that I was such a huge fan, because that was always the weak link for me was Joey. He was a little goofy on stage, and my friends and I would make fun of him, and his people have compared him to like Dio, and he doesn't have that range. He doesn't have as much control over his voice. So once they replaced him with John Bush in the 90s, mm-hmm. I was completely happy with that. However, yeah. These last two albums they did with Joey, he sounds great now.
Yeah.
And I've heard some live.
Yeah.
His voice has developed quite a bit.
Yeah. I think just cause he's not getting as screechy. There's just more grit and roughness to it. I really enjoyed that. Yeah. I also really enjoyed the John Bush stuff, but the thing that kept me away from the John Bush stuff was there's just so many damn lyrics. It felt like there was like no room for the guitars and all that to breathe.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. And nonsensical lyrics. Yeah. I think it was last fall or summer, Anthrax celebrated their 40th anniversary. So they put up all these videos on YouTube on their channel about their history, and they would go pretty much album by album. And they were talking about the 90s and how they never really reached the levels that the other guys in the big four did. And Scott Ian blamed grunge. And I was like, that doesn't really make sense, because Megadeth had a number two album, I think the same year that Nevermind came out, or maybe that was the number four album. And then when they put out Euthanasia, I think that made it to number two. Metallica, of course, became like the biggest band in the world. So I really think their lyrics hindered them in that era, because yeah. they're really not about anything. This vague sort of interpersonal conflict they all seem to be about, but you can't mm-hmm. really pin down what they're talking about.
Yeah, that's a perfect encapsulation of what I think is, you know, why they never latched on, or they never hit as well as the other bands. Because, you know, Megadeth, they have that kind of like, you know, besides the hook of the guitar, you know, heroics that, you know, people were attracted to, there's also, you know, a lot of like, you could expect like sci-fi or like horror type themes and sure. stuff like that. And with Metallica, you know, they had catchy songs. They had, you know, really personal songs in the mid 90s and all that. So they went, you know, they were much more direct, I think, with their feelings mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Oh, and definitely, and getting Bob Rock in there to sweeten up those albums and really make them poppy.
I don't know what your opinions are of the Load and Reload era of Metallica is, but I think you'd be hard pressed to find albums that sound as good as that.
I've never listened to either of those albums all the way through. I know the singles off of those, and that was when they lost me in terms of the visual look of the band and just their behavior at that point. Seeing Kurt smoke cigars, and I was like, not that the visual needs to really match, but it, I don't know.
It's part of, like, you thought these, you know, it seemed like such a shift from what they were before.
Well, yeah. And you wonder, you know, if Cliff had lived, would they have still gone through that change, you know, or would he have bailed at that point? I mean, he wasn't the most handsome guy, so I can't see him making that transition into that cleaned up kind of glammy look they had there for a while.
Well, I think you can make that argument for all the guys.
Well, that's true. I do remember seeing a thing with Sebastian Bach talking about getting Kill 'Em All, and he was looking at the back of Kill 'Em All. He's like, these are the ugliest guys I've ever seen in my life.
I think, you know, I've read a lot of, you know, I'm a huge Metallica fan, and I've, you know, I was in my teens in the mid to late 90s, so I was there for all the, like, extra stuff they did to, like, just inundate you, like the live shit, Binge and Purge, the year and a half of Metallica, the videos, all that stuff. So I was all there for it. You know, I was, there was a website called Inter Sandman, like internet, okay, that I would go to every day for, like, and they would have, like, you know, trying to, like, download, you know, demos at, like, whatever 56k modem you had at the time. So I was huge into it. So whenever someone's like, you know, if Cliff was still alive, they wouldn't have done that. And it's like, everything I've read about Cliff and all that, they probably would have went into, like, an even crazier direction, or they probably would have went the same way, because Cliff was a guy who brought in a lot of different influences for them.
That's true. That's very true.
Mainly, like, his bass solo in Ryan. Listen to the solo to Eagles Hotel California. He steals the lick right from there. So it's like, Cliff was the guy who probably would have pushed him. Like, you wouldn't get Justice if Cliff was still in the band. I firmly believe that. But that's, you know, that's just my opinion. And
yeah, I mean, it's so hard to say, you know, what elements a particular member of the band brings to the table with that stuff. Because even you can, I mean, Metallica out of any band is, like, the most open about letting you into the studio and seeing every part of the process. But even then, you're not getting every single hour of every single day. You're getting a condensed version of that. So it is difficult to say, you know, how these decisions happen and the direction that a band takes, you know, could hinge on one single decision on one given day.
Yeah. You know, and the general, you know, or the general, like, I guess, story is that after Justice, they're like, man, this is like a fucking marathon every night. Like,
oh, sure.
We need to scale this shit. Like, we need to change this up.
Yeah.
So, you know, I believe that as a creator myself, I believe that, where it's like, you go so hard into one direction, you're like, all right, I kind of did that already. Now, what do I do next? So anyway, this is not Metallica chat. I'll pull it back. Anthrax, way back. See, Anthrax can't catch a break. We started talking about Anthrax, and then it's been 10 minutes on Metallica.
I mean, that's just the way it goes. I spend way too much time thinking about the ins and outs of these bands and you know, some bit of information that they said in an interview 20 years ago stuck with me. And I'm thinking, like, I remember them talking about Joey after they kicked him out. And there was one of those music video magazines, I think it was called Hard and Heavy, you know, listening to the guys in Anthrax talking about their lot in life, you know, being bitter about their old singer, being bitter about their place among metal in general, and especially within the Big Four. Like, when they did those Big Four reunion shows, I guess they weren't reunions, but Anyway, when they brought the Big Four together, I think Anthrax opened all those shows.
Yeah.
And that's got to sting a little bit. And I don't know how that decision happened, if it was all just management. But you do have to, if you're going to rank them in terms of their success, of course, Anthrax is going to be at the bottom of that. I mean, they're still in the Big Four, so you can't complain too much. But I know that I remember Scott Ian saying that Metallica was basically Anthrax with money. But I think that's a pretty reductive way of looking at it. I think there's other elements there that that play into why one band is the biggest band in the world and the other band is sort of well known.
Yeah.
But the thing about that is I think that when you're starting out the same, you know, when they started out and Johnny Z from Megaforce introduced Metallica to Anthrax, they did see themselves as the same, on the same level at that point. So I think that's always going to stick in your mind of like, well, we started out the same, so we are the same. To the outside world, it's not that way. But if you were there in the beginning, you're going to feel that way.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, being the Metallica head I am, you know, I know that, you know, when they first moved to New York, Anthrax is the one who helped put them up in their, you know, shitty rehearsal space and all that. And yeah, so it's just that thing, I guess.
Well, and I think Anthrax hurt themselves too, in a way. It was very cool at the time when they were teaming up with Public Enemy and, you know, going on TV shows and everything, but it did make them seem a little goofier than the other three bands, especially, you know, you compare them to Slayer. Slayer wasn't doing stuff like that. So I don't know. I mean, it's Anthrax for the most part is still my favorite among the Big Four in terms of just my emotional attachment to them, because they were the first thrash band that I really got into. If I had to really pick of the Big Four who was the best, I'd probably go with Slayer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I think out of all of them, Slayer is probably my least favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And not to just beat a dead joke into the ground, but it's like, I like the one song they do.
Yeah.
But it's kind of the one song, you know, it's, I feel like, I think I appreciate more who Slayer influenced afterwards.
Sure.
Than them themselves.
Okay.
So, you know, I can appreciate their status and their contribution to the genre in general, but them in of themselves, like, you know, the first, you know, that first beginning intro to Hell Awaits and all that. Yeah, that's absolutely like probably my favorite thing they've ever done.
Sure.
But then, you know, everything else is like, yeah, that's cool. Then after a while, I just, yeah. I think it's more of the, it's just their particular style of thrash is just not what I was really into.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's crazy though, when you think about the amount of thrash bands that there were at that time, because I was completely unaware of the deeper stuff like Nasty Savage. You know, you had to have been a huge, huge metalhead in the late 80s to even know about that other stuff, where you're going to the record store and buying these albums with these really shitty covers. I wasn't a record store kid. I was a Columbia House kid. So they only stocked the real popular stuff. So yeah. I wasn't even aware of those other thrash bands. And I'm sure there was great stuff at the time. I've listened to some of it since. You know, I just didn't really have access to it.
Yeah. You know, you brought up Columbia House a couple of times, and I was a Columbia House kid myself. Were you, did you, like, if you had to guess, like, how many albums did you actually pay full price for versus you actually getting?
I mean, I was pretty much with them throughout the end of junior high into high school. And then when I graduated high school in 91, I made the switch over to CDs. And I think I canceled my membership at that point, because I was just getting cassettes. And I would say it's probably about half and half. I got, you know, that initial 12. I think at one point I canceled and then re-upped. So I got another 12. But yeah, it was just... more than anything, I loved ordering stuff out of catalogs. That was the biggest part of it. Mm-hmm. I still am that way. I love looking through catalogs. That probably had more to do with it than an actual love of music.
Yeah, I don't think we have a major age difference. So I'm still, when you get talk about catalogs, it's like, yeah, you know, I was all about the catalogs. I still have fond memories of searching through. Do you remember the Highlander TV show? Uh-huh. Used to have a catalog.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And my brothers and I would just pore over this thing. You could like buy like all these like random like Scottish and symbol swords and all this just junk.
Yeah.
That's all this crazy stuff you would get, like, you know, at a booth in the con now.
Sure. Yeah. But
it was, you know, back in the day, you know, Christmas rolls around, you had the giant catalog, you had service merchandise, you had all these things, man.
Oh, service merchandise. I haven't thought about that in forever.
Yeah. Catalogs, you know, looking around and having everything at your fingertips online is nice and convenient, but there's a little bit of magic lost.
Yeah, definitely. Especially when, you know, I used to collect movies on videotape, just bootlegs from various companies. And same thing, it was, you know, these guys would send out these catalog updates, and that was more almost as enjoyable as watching the movies sometimes, I would say.
Well, I think we covered metal pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you like to chat about next? Coffee or comics?
Let's go with coffee.
All right. Generally, you know, I personally, you can talk about your coffee to whatever extent you like, but I am all here for if you want to get into the nitty gritty of like how you like your grounds, what kind of roasts you like, how do you take it? You know, if you're just like, I don't care, you know, hot black liquid, fine, that's fine too.
Yeah.
I've had all types on this show.
Yeah,
but feel free to dive into your coffee experiences.
Okay, yeah. I mean, growing up, you know, we had Folgers in the house, and I would drink coffee every now and then as a kid, and just as much cream and sugar as I could put in it. And then stopped. Once I was in high school, I never even thought about drinking coffee. And then it wasn't until I got together with my wife that we got a coffee maker, and I started making coffee on a regular basis. And she used to be a barista. So she was the one who introduced me to the idea of buying whole beans and grinding at home. And I couldn't believe the difference. I was so used to just having this really horrible canned coffee my whole life. So to have an actual decent, you know, cup of coffee from fresh ground beans was amazing. Yeah. So we've stayed with that, ever since then. And, what I'm buying lately is, Stumptown, in terms of what you can just get at the grocery store. I know Target stocks it.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently tried a few Stumptown blends after I saw that, Stumptown, was being carried by them. And my buddy Ben Dewey was on the show, too long ago. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he's a big fan of Stumptown, so I was keeping my eye out for that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The 100 Mile is really good. Yeah. I like the lighter stuff that's a little sweeter. I don't put any sugar in my coffee now. It's all just cream. My wife drinks it black. So she likes a lighter roast for that reason. Mm-hmm. For a little while I was drinking cold brew, but I just started getting real tweaky on that. So basically it's just maybe 3-4 cups of hot coffee throughout the day.
Awesome. Yeah. I like the 100 Mile blend, the Hairbender they had there, the blend. That one's really good too.
Yeah. I haven't tried that yet. I've had the, what was the other one? It starts with an H. I can't remember the other one, but it's in a blue bag, I think.
If you're looking for other good ones or curious to try other ones, Two Brothers Coffee is really good as well.
We get that, yeah, because you can get that at Costco. You can get the big 2-pound or 3-pound bags at Costco.
I listeners to the show know I love Rootless Coffee. They're based out of Flint, Michigan.
Okay.
They are excellent. Their damn fine cup of coffee blend was like my go-to.
Yeah.
For ever since it came out, ever since, you know, because their company's of what, I think a year and a half old now.
Okay.
So ever since they debuted, I've been drinking that, and I've been absolutely in love with it. But then they recently had, I'm forgetting the name of it now, but it was inspired by Big Lebowski, mm-hmm. the cover art and all that.
Yeah.
And that like is somehow just even more amazing. So if you're looking to get a mail order coffee at some point, I highly recommend Rootless.
Rootless. Okay. I'll write that down. Yeah, that sounds good. There was, so we just moved to Chicago actually a little over 2 years ago. And before that we lived in Denver.
Okay.
And, we went to this motel. There's this boutique motel in Salida, Colorado, and they were serving Huckleberry coffee, which I think now they're called Huck. And found out that they were actually based in Denver, and then found out that they were right up the street from the big Mile High Comics warehouse.
Oh.
So every couple weeks, I'd go to Mile High Comics, dig through their dollar bins, and then go to Huck and get some coffee from them. They got great mugs, too. I like real thick, like diner mugs. And so I snatched some of those up before we moved.
Nice. Well, that's awesome. You know, it's kind of crazy just how like much good coffee there is out there these days. And just you can find, like, I've been doing a lot of like, I'll search Illinois roasters and I'll just, mm-hmm. I've just been ordering random bags to try stuff out and talk about for the show and all that. And yeah, I keep finding like these little roasters in our area that are just like putting out amazing stuff. And it's like, I'm surprised that one, I can tell the difference between all the different coffees.
Sure. Yeah.
And two, that just that the quality means to be so high with all of these things.
It's crazy. I mean, we've probably got 10 independently owned coffee places within a 5 mile radius of us. There's a great place called, I think it's called Four Letter Word. And they have an instant coffee that's actually really good. Mm-hmm. We got a couple packets of that. People, of course, are always going to have a problem with Starbucks, and I completely get it. But I do feel like Starbucks, in a way, gave people the taste for better coffee, and then from that went on to, you know, even more gourmet stuff. And you know, the popularity, I think, was spearheaded by them. But the fact that it has allowed all these other shops to open up, I think, is pretty cool.
No, 100%. Like, I still go to Starbucks, but I don't drink the coffee. I just get the chai lattes or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I can't stand the coffee in of itself. But mm-hmm. I did, you know, my old employer used to have the bags for the break room and all that. So I did, you know, get a better taste of coffee, or, you know, a desire for better coffee.
Oh, after sure. Yeah.
Getting kind of used to that and all that. So that's our one, that's like our big vice or our splurge for my wife and I. We, you know, we're not drinkers or anything like that. So, you know, our thing is we'll buy some really nice coffee. And sometimes if we get a blend that we're not really caring for, we'll give it to my in-laws and they drink the Aldi's
uh-huh.
bucket coffee.
yeah.
So whenever we give them something that, you know, we bought, they're like, that was so good. How much is it? And we tell them how much it is. And they're like, no, thank you.
Oh, it's, yeah. I mean, it's still cheaper than if you just went and got a cup at the store, you know, but I mean, I'm spending, you know, $15 for a pound of coffee. That is pretty crazy if you think about it, but on a day-to-day basis, it's not that big of a deal. And it's funny. I was just watching, Pulp Fiction the other day. And at the end of the movie, when Quentin Tarantino gives them all a cup of coffee and they're telling him how good the coffee is, he's like, I know how good it is. I buy it. And I remember seeing that scene at the time when I didn't drink coffee. I was like, well, how could coffee be good? Like, how could you tell if coffee was good or not? And, you know, now I understand how you can get good coffee.
Awesome. Oh, sir. You know, I make sure to note, what comics have you been digging lately? Have you been reading old stuff? Are you reading new stuff? Do you even have time to read comics?
I don't. Well, it's not so much that I don't have time. I mean, that is somewhat true, but my eyesight has gotten really, really bad in the last few years. And it's, it's to the point when I get done, like I have to take multiple breaks throughout the day when I'm drawing, because I have to get super close to the paper, and I draw such small details a lot of the time that sitting down with a comic book or even just a prose book can be difficult on my eyes. Mm-hmm. So I tend to just watch a little TV and then maybe I'll read something for like a half hour. And when I say read, a lot of times I'll just grab a back issue and flip through it and look at the art. But I did just get, over Christmas, I got two Alberto Breccia books from Fantagraphics. I got the Paramus collection and the Dracula collection, and both of those are excellent. They're really, really good.
Awesome. Well, sir, you know, I want to dive in and talk to you about your just tremendously successful campaign. And is it Cancor or Cancor or...
You know, I was, when I did my video for the campaign, I did one initially where I, every time I would say Cancor, I would say it differently, put a different emphasis on parts of the word, just because I honestly don't know. And there's, there's different iterations. There's one with two R's, there's one with a K. I don't know if you pronounce those differently or not. It's up to you, however you want to say it.
Okay. Great, great. But before we get into that, I posted on social media, you know, that we're talking today, and if anyone had any questions, and oh boy, we got a lot of questions.
Oh, good. Okay.
Probably the most amount of questions I've ever gotten for a guest.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Really, really, people turned up.
Cool. That's great to hear.
So, I'd like to kind of, knock some of these out if you don't mind.
Sure.
First up is my buddy, Kelly Williams at Treebeard. He wants to know, do you ever feel bad about how awesome his work is? Your work is.
Well, I know Kelly too. I've gone to the AirCap Con in Wichita a few times and hung out with Kelly. He's a super cool dude. No. I don't know how to answer that question. I'll just say no.
Just know that we all feel bad about how awesome your work is.
Okay. All right.
No, Kelly's awesome.
Yeah.
Next up is John Westhoff with Part-Time Comics. He wants to know, what made you want to self-publish over finding a publisher again?
I'll say this. My experience working with Ad House was overall extremely positive. The only issue that I ended up having was the book sold out, and it sold out relatively quickly, but we did have a smaller print run. The option was there to print more, and what it would have meant was that I would have to give up my half of the profits in order to fund an additional printing. And at that point, I felt like, well, you know, I'm basically becoming a co-publisher at that point, and if that's the case, I should just do it all myself. Nothing against Chris at all. It was just more purely of just like, well, at this point, I've got other material that wasn't in the Ad House edition. People have asked me about that enough times where I felt like this is a good opportunity for me to collect all of it. Plus, I had just done the most recent book, Anamnesis, last year. So I just, you know, if Ad House was still around, I probably would have talked to Chris about it, but you know, because he ended that operation last year as well, that wasn't an option. And I just had seen so many people have great success on Kickstarter and other crowdfunding platforms that it just felt like the right thing to do. Plus, it gives me complete control over it. I get all the headaches that go along with it, but I get to make all the decisions. So that was the main part of it.
Perfect. Next question is from Instagram and to Shaniger. What was your first interaction with comics?
My dad had a box of comic books in the garage, and they weren't comics that I should have seen because they were like Warren 1984 comics, which mm-hmm. have tons of sex and nudity and violence. And mm-hmm. There were some creepy comics in there. So, you know, I saw that stuff, but I knew I really wasn't supposed to be looking at it. But beyond that, my parents always bought me comic books. That was just a standard thing in the 70s, where you go to the grocery store. And even if I didn't go with my mom to the grocery store, she would buy me one or two comics. So I can't really pinpoint a specific comic that was my first, other than to just say that, you know, they were just something that were always in our house, whether it was Mad Magazine or the little Archie Digest that just was part of growing up.
Yeah, I think, you know, your generation, and again, you know, mine, I'm not too far off from you. I think I was born in 82. I don't know what.
73.
Okay, so, you know, yeah. In terms of, I guess, growing up experiences, not really that much different, because in terms of, like, you know, my first interaction with comics was just, they were always around. I had older brothers, and they're just all over. They're just around.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's kind of I see it more now lately, but for a while, a lot of people I would talk to who, like, you know, what was your first comics experience? It was like, they just didn't have them around.
Sure.
So it was, I think after the 90s imploded, I think a lot of people just didn't want comics in their home.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. I think that, you know, comics were devalued definitely at that point, but you know, comics is a language, and I think you have to be immersed in it to really get it. So if you don't have it from an early age and you try getting into it a little later, it could just seem like gibberish to you. I've definitely tried to get people into comics who didn't grow up with them, and it's a little bit of a struggle sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, our next question comes from Charles Forsman. He wants to know, what's your favorite Ace Frehley solo?
I love the solo in Love 'Em and Leave 'Em, and it's because when I hear it, I imagine Ace playing it in the video, where there's a point where he's just using his left hand, and instead of picking, he's pointing at the strings as though he's magically making the sound come from the strings with his right hand, and by not actually touching it, just using his space powers. So, but it's a great solo anyways. It's real. It's got some phase on it. I like that solo a lot, for sure.
Are you a big Kiss fan?
A huge, yeah. In fact, I was just talking to Skinner today about Kiss, how I've got a love-hate relationship with them. Them as people, I don't like so much, but I Kiss is another thing just grew up with, and it's always been a part of my life.
Since you moved to Chicago, are you familiar with Challengers Comics in Chicago?
I've been there. I've been to one of their locations. I think they have two, right?
They opened the second location just before the pandemic happened.
Yeah.
So unfortunately they had to close that, but their original location is still open and thriving.
Okay.
But their co-owner, Patrick Brower, huge Kiss fan.
Okay. Okay.
Buddy of mine. So if you're ever in there and you see Patrick, you guys instantly.
Okay, perfect. I'll take any opportunity to talk about Kiss. We talked about Metallica. If it had been Kiss that was mentioned at any point there, that's would have been this whole podcast. So.
Yeah, actually, he and I were working on a cover of God of Thunder.
Oh, nice.
With some other comic people that, you know. But yeah, it's. I'm not a huge Kiss guy, but again, it's one of those things where it's like I can certainly appreciate what they did. Mm-hmm. And all that, and not a huge fan of them as people, though I think Paul Stanley's all right. I think he seems to be a decent guy from what I can tell, but you know,
I was surprised. I listened to his autobiography not too long ago, and I thought I was gonna just be seething the whole time because he likes to talk a lot of shit about Peter and Ace. But when I heard his side of it, like, it had to have been very difficult to work with those guys. And when you learn about Paul's childhood and the life he had growing up, you start to understand why he wouldn't want to be around crazy, messed up alcoholics and drug addicts. So, he's a pretty decent guy. Horrible artist, but...
you know, especially, you know, given how some older musicians seem to have some really bad takes about current events. He yeah. seems to be, you know, someone that seems to be still have a good head on his shoulders, I guess.
Yeah, definitely a good yang to Gene's yin. Mm-hmm. He balances Gene's insanity out for sure.
For sure, for sure. Well, I'm gonna pose this next thing to you. We have a few more questions. We can go through these, or we can continue on, and then we'll come back to the questions. What are you feeling up to?
Yeah, let's just continue on and take some questions afterwards.
All right, cool. So with the Kickstarter for Canaccord, I have a horrible admission, and that is I have never read any of it.
Uh-huh.
I've only admired the art online, and I sure. always like, I should really order these books. And then, you know, the ad house thing, I'm like, oh, I should get that. I should definitely get that. You know, all my yeah. buddies order the books and I see them. I'm like, this is one of those things where I should really do this. And then whatever happens, you know, I don't. So then when I saw you're like, you know, you're going to be doing a thing for the whole thing, I'm like, well, shit, I have to do this now. So
yeah,
I cannot wait to read it all. But if someone who's, you know, I have, you know, based on what I've seen and all that, I have a general idea of what the book is about. But for someone who may not know what Canaccord is about, would you give us a quick synopsis of the book?
Yeah, sure. At its core, what I'm doing with it is telling some autobiographical stories and incorporating some fantasy, surreal elements into it. So there's two worlds going on. There's the world of myself in my 20s, back in the mid to late 90s, struggling to be an artist, struggling just to be a decent human being. And then parallel to that is Canaccord and all his different iterations having somewhat similar struggles, you know, staying in one piece. In terms of how the comics are created, I didn't really think about this till the other day. I was watching a documentary about Del Close, who is the guy that started or was one of the people to start Second City improv group and then Improv Olympics. And they were talking about improv comedy and performance, and I was realizing that the way that I make my comics is very similar to how improv comedians form a scene, where somebody in the audience gives a suggestion, gives a one word suggestion, or they'll tell a story and that prompts them to go off into this narrative that they create on the spot. That's how I create these Canaccord comics. I'll have a panel that will just come out of the blue. For instance, in one of my stories, I have Canaccord climbing this mountain. And he pulls on this stalactite looking thing and this Batman corpse comes out of the mountain. And I had no idea what that meant. I didn't know what happened before, what happened after. And I had to reverse engineer to the story to get to that. It's like, well, he's got to come from somewhere to get up this mountain. So how does that happen? And it just all comes together piece by piece. So I don't script any of this stuff. It is a little dreamlike in spots. So anybody going into it who hasn't read it before, just know that it's not traditional comic book storytelling, you know, you're going to get like an Image comic or a Dark Horse comic or anything like that. It's more in line with, I always say I'm trying to make comics like Jim Woodring, but whereas Jim Woodring uses funny animals, I'm using superheroes.
Okay. That's a great example. The book is just, you know, in your art style, it's just utterly fascinating to me. Just the sheer amount of, I think, precision and detail that you put into everything, it's like, as someone as myself, I love seeing detail in artwork, but if to sit down and do it myself to the level that, you know, like you do it, I think I would go insane. I wouldn't have the patience for that. Is that something, when you're making your artwork, do you have a clear vision of what it's going to look like as you're laying it down? Or is that kind of like how the comics form too? Like you have a, you know, a general idea, or you start somewhere and then you just, it goes where it goes.
Yeah. More the latter. I think that, you know, quite often, I'll start inking before I've even finished penciling. Mm-hmm. So I may have a splash page and I know how, how a hand is going to look or where the person's leg is positioned. And I get that sketched in somewhat. And if I get that looking right, I feel like, well, I'm going to go in and lay down some ink and see if that feels good. And then it just goes from there. In the beginning, a lot of times by the midway point, I'd completely botched it and I would tear the page up and start over again. And, you know, I have friends who draw in a more traditional manner who hear about that. And they're like, that is the craziest, dumbest way to make comics. Like, why don't you, you know, do thumbnails and then blow those up and then redraw it and pencil? And I was like, it all comes out in the wash in terms of the amount of time that you're spending. At least, you know, that's how it seems to me. And then as far as, you know, the detail side of it, you know, when I'm doing something that has a ton of those little wires or a ton of feathering, it becomes meditative for me to just draw that stuff over and over. And then my hand may give out, and obviously it's, you know, just wreaked havoc on my eyes. But in terms of getting into a zone, if I'm listening to music that's really droning, you know, ambient music, and I'm drawing that fine detail, I get lost in it. So it's the opposite of stressful a lot of the times.
That was gonna be my next question. Like when you are doing all the feathering and all that, which is just, it just appears immaculate as every time you post something. I was gonna ask, it has to be like some sort of meditative thing.
Sure.
I think that's the only way. I can, that's the only way my brain can parse someone doing that to that degree.
Yeah. I mean, I look at Jim Woodring again, and I see, you know, the way he renders his skies, it's always the same kind of wavy lines, stack of wavy lines. And I just think like, man, he locked into that early on and he's drawn that again and again and again, and he must get something out of it. Something almost spiritual. I know he is a very spiritual person, so I think the meditative aspect of making those kinds of lines on the page must do that for him.
Oh, hello, fellow humans. You caught me in the middle of drinking coffee while reading comics and listening to metal. Do you ever get curious about how your favorite creators get their inspiration? Have you ever wondered what led them down this path? Well, join me, noted comic book heartthrob Grant Stoy, as I do deep dive interviews with some of the best comic book folks around on Into the Comics Cave. Each week we examine a creator's history and find out stuff like where they grew up or whether or not birds with lips are sexy. You can find us on Apple, Stitchers, most anywhere you stream your podcasts. Now back to my favorite hugger in the world, Don Cardenas.
Well, I was going to ask, and this was also a question that was asked on Instagram, I have to say this name. My bootylicious-ness is a curse.
Oh yeah.
How does it feel to have your fundraiser just 100%ed in a couple of hours? Was it a giant weight off of your shoulders, or was it like you could take a breath, but then you're like, oh shit, like what do I do now? I got to keep pushing because you got all this time left in the campaign.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously the relief because just, you know, the fact that I have a deposit looming, you know, I've been talking to a printer for a few months now, and I had to pre-schedule the book because, you know, with supply chain issues, a lot of books are being pushed back because, you know, the people are running out of paper. So I knew it was like, I have to do this in February. I've got to get it locked in pretty quick because I've got a deposit that's due in March. So that part of it was a relief to know that I had made enough money to cover that deposit. But then from that point on, I was walking around the house on Monday and my wife asked me, she's like, what's going on with you? You seem really distraught. You should be really happy. You just, you know, completely funded your book in 3 hours. Why are you seemingly upset? And I just said, I'm like, man, the other shoe is going to drop. Like, I know something bad is going to happen. I'm going to screw something up. I'm going to, you know, I didn't enter the right price or like something's wrong here. And, I did have a pretty major hiccup that first night where all of the pledges from that day, I got an email from the CEO at Fundraiser because he congratulated me for the success of the campaign. And I think this is like the largest comic book campaign they've had on that platform far. And he said, you know, if you want, you can go ahead and you can, you know, process those pledges. And I didn't even think about it. I was like, okay, yeah, great. So I hit process. And then I start seeing messages from people saying, whoa, I didn't think I was going to get charged for this for like another 30 days. And, you know, some people didn't really have the funds. They just wanted to make sure that they got it locked into place, assuming that they were going to get charged at the end of the month. And I just immediately freaked out. I was like, oh my God, I got to make this right for people. So I started contacting anybody that I knew was having issues. And the last couple of days has just been sorting all that stuff out. There have been some people that somehow ended up with duplicate orders. So I've been working with Fundraiser on taking care of that, but today was a lot smoother. Things are back on track. So just a couple bumpy days there.
Okay. Yeah. I was one of the ones who, you know, had their order processed, which I was fine with because, you know, with when it comes to the like Kickstarters and all that, I have my own separate stash of cash I use for that. So yeah. So when it went through and I saw, oh, okay, I'm like, oh, then I'm like, is it, I just like I assumed that's how Fundraiser worked. Like, oh no, they take the money up front. Which I was like, okay, that's fine. That's cool. So but I'm sorry to hear you had such a stressful thing happen and some people may have gotten a little upset, but I'm hopefully they're all like, okay, cool, we understand. Let's just fix this situation. Yeah.
And I got some mixed feedback. I did have some people say that they had gone back and they'd looked and it did say that you would be charged once the campaign was fully funded, which again it was in 3 hours. Yeah. So there were people that were expecting it. Other people just because I think Kickstarter was normally like that. Again, like I don't need the money till March, so it wasn't even that I needed to process it. It was I'm a person who basically if somebody says, hey, you know, take this across the street, I take it across the street, I don't question it. So when I got that email saying go ahead and process, I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's what I do without, now.
Yeah. So
well, again, yeah, hopefully it simmers down.
Yep.
And all that. One of the things, along with your art on your Instagram, I like seeing you post is your old school iPod.
Sure.
And just, you know, you putting whatever you're listening to up on there. Is music like the main thing you listen to while you're working, or, do you sometimes have like, what's your like surroundings like when you work? Because that fascinates me, you know, how everyone's kind of a little bit different. Some people like to work in, you know, stone cold silence sometimes. Mm-hmm. And other people like, you know, like me, have to have like two or three things around them because that's the only way their brain will focus on the thing that's in front of them.
Sure.
So what's your working situation like when you sit down at the board?
I switch it up. For the most part, I'll start the day off with a podcast. Usually something scripted, conversational podcasts sometimes can be difficult for me because I have I have some noise sensitivity issues as I lay out in one of my comics. So if there's any, you know, repetitive noises or repetitive phrases used by the hosts, I tend to like get a little antsy. So if it's a scripted thing, like I like this podcast called Decoder Ring, where they just choose a subject, talk about it for an hour, go into the history. Those I can tolerate a little more. There are a few comic book podcasts I listen to. There's a Kiss podcast called Pot of Thunder. And I've been catching up on that because that's been going for like 7 years and I just discovered it. And I'll usually do that. I'll have breakfast and then I'll switch over to music and I'll make myself a playlist on the iPod and or occasionally just put it on shuffle. So that's usually like when I post those iPod pictures, it's like, oh, cool song just came up on shuffle, you know, just to let people know what I'm listening to in the moment. And then I may switch back to a podcast. I know people that will watch a movie while they're inking or drawing, and I can't have anything visual going on. I don't really listen to audiobooks, although I am listening to one now. That's a autobiography. If it's like a prose novel or something, like I tried listening to Dune. Mm-hmm. I can't concentrate on the story that I'm trying to create as I'm listening to a story. So I have discovered that I can't really do audiobooks that often.
Yeah, especially as you've laid out, you've kind of, it's almost improv-like with yeah. how you're doing everything. Yeah, I imagine that having someone else's conflicting narrative going yeah. on in your head, it's like, yeah, unable to focus. I'm trying to be better about having visual things on while I'm working. Mm-hmm. Because I have ADHD, so I'm kind of like, I kind of need like a background noise sure. thing happening for most things I do.
Yep.
And so it's, I've tried working in silence and all that before, and it just, working in silence to me is kind of like nails on a chalkboard. Mm-hmm. So,
oh yeah.
So, you know, and it becomes to such a point where it's like, I've run out of all these things to have on in the background while I'm going. So like I'm pivoting back around to music. And also for this show, I like to like talk about new music and stuff like that. So I actively have to go find new albums and stuff like that. Cause otherwise, yeah, I'd probably be listening to like Metallica and, you know, Pantera and Sabbath, just mm-hmm. repeat, repeat, repeat.
Yep.
So, a question I had, but also a person from Instagram, Frank B. Fallon, also had was, what inspires you most when it comes to your comics?
I mean, if I was gonna, that's a good question, because usually if I hear that, my mind starts going to other comics, but I don't usually look at other comics in order to gain inspiration. A lot of times if I'm watching a movie, there may be a moment in a film where I start to piece together what the screenwriter did in terms of working through a problem in the plot, and that will inspire me to, you know, figure out something that I'm struggling with, piecing some scenes together. And it's not a matter of using what they did in the plot, because it's often something that has nothing to do with the comic that I'm making. It's just that idea of like, oh, if you have a callback to this thing, then that's going to make a connection that's going to help the readers understand this a little better. So, you know, watching movies, I think, is the number one thing that helps me in terms of creating the narrative of the mm-hmm. story, for sure.
Awesome. Awesome. And I don't want to dominate our conversation with all these questions from outside people, but I do want to, you know, they took the time to ask. So I want to make sure I hit everybody up. You know, Outlet Press is asking, who is your biggest artistic inspiration? If I could cut in real quick, I'm going to assume Woodring.
Yeah.
Based on how
yeah.
much you've discussed him yeah, already.
Pretty much. I mean, I would say in terms of creating, I don't consider myself a spiritual person, so it is a little bizarre that I gravitate so much to somebody who defines himself that way. Mm-hmm. So more so than Woodring in terms of the type of comic that I want to make, would be Dan Klaus and 8-Ball in particular. Mm-hmm. The ability to just throw anything and everything that you can think of into a comic. If you want to have a horror comic, you can do that. If you want to have a comic about two girls shopping at a thrift store, you can do that. 8 Ball made me realize, like, you can do anything with comics. You don't have to stick to one genre. You don't have to, just worry about only telling horror stories or only telling autobiographical stuff. You can work all of that into one thing. So I would definitely go with Dan Klaus.
And I would say, even with his art style, I could definitely see a correlation between your style and his style with Dan Klaus. Like, just do you consider him like a visual inspiration as well?
Yeah, for sure. When I first started making what I would consider to be more alternative comics in the 90s, I was very much just aping his style. I really wanted to draw that way. I didn't like to show people those drawings. I had, in my sketchbook, you can definitely pinpoint and say, okay, that's, you doing Dan Klaus. Here's a little bit of Woodring. Here's a little bit of Al Columbia. But the fact that it was very clear that he was using comic book making tools, like in particular Zippitone, his use of Zippitone was something that really stood out to me for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A very open-end question is, I'm hoping there's some sort of background to this, but Jamjar666 asked how. I don't know if that's was a question for me on how to ask you a question, or if that's just someone you interact with online, and it's some sort of just
Yeah, I don't recognize that name. I'll try to answer as best as I can. I would just say from right to left.
There you go. We do have a question about Cancor, and this is pertinent. How many Cancors or variation of Cancors are there? Are they infinite?
Yes, they are infinite. Mm-hmm. There is no set number. I think that if I did sit down and do like a who's who or a Hotmu type guidebook to all the different Cancors, I think I would get sick of it after a while. So I would have to just stop at a certain point and say, okay, there's 50 of them or however many
known Cancors.
yeah. I mean, there's scenes where there's just, piles of Cancor inside of other Cancors. So it's pretty endless.
I do have to bring up how much I love the naming scheme of the ORR at the end. Like, just anything with that or on it. That's just icing on the cake for me. Whenever I see anything that has, a gore at the end, just like this. I don't know, for something like that, it just tickles me so well.
Thank you.
Now I have some questions from some of my buddies who I assume, since they're Chicago based, maybe your buddies as well. Okay. Tyrell Cannon.
Yeah.
Great man. And current record holder for most listens to one of our episodes.
Oh, wow.
He's our most downloaded episode. Best live performance you've been to?
Wow. My wife and I were just listening to David Bowie the other day. We were talking about having seen Bowie in 2004. And I would have loved to have said that was the best. And we went online, we looked at what the set list was. And as we were looking at the set list, I was like, man, I don't even remember this concert. And I was drinking at the time, but I don't, so it would be nice to say Bowie. But I think for me, my sister took me to see that band, The Eels, up in Boulder. And I knew nothing about them. I knew one song, the song Fly Swatter. I think maybe I'd heard Soul Jacker, but I didn't even know that was them. And the show was just amazing. And it was made more so by the fact that I didn't really know any of the music. It's just the stage performance and the vibe of the crowd. I would have to say that was, one of the cooler concert experiences I've had.
Awesome. And then, buddy, Jonathan Lamantia wants to know, if you could collaborate on a book with any creator living or dead, who would it be and who would do what?
Well, I mean, I have said for a while I would love to see an Alex Ross cover for a Kankor book. That's exactly, that doesn't really answer Jonathan's question. I did actually throw that out to Chris Pitzer when we were working on that collection. As like, yeah, it'd be really cool. We could run, you know, Kickstarter, try to get enough money to pay him to do it. He wasn't interested at all. I don't know. You know, honestly, like I don't think about collaborating all that often. And I do have a concept for a comic that's very 90s image based. And I've thought, like, maybe I won't draw it. Maybe I will write it and get somebody to draw it. But I haven't really come up with the perfect artist for that. So I'll just choose Jonathan. Jonathan and I should make a comic together.
The amount of Micron corpses that will be left in your wake.
It's amazing. Him and do you know Matt Lesniewski?
Yes, I had Matt on. Amazing. And I think since I had him on, his art has just, I had him on, I think, in August. He took like another turn with his art.
Oh yeah.
And it's just like, come on, man.
It's
stop being so good, but and actually don't stop.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like I feel bad, like I would comment on some of his Instagram posts and it was always the same thing, you know, just telling him how amazing it is. And at a certain point, I was like, I have to quit, you know, being a fanboy about his stuff. But it's, if I could draw like anybody currently working in comics, I would probably choose Matt because his stuff is mind blowing.
Yeah, he has such a, you know, and I extend that to your art as well, and Jonathan. It's like you guys have such unique styles that, you know, just the mere thought of thinking of you guys on something even more mainstream is like, that would be really cool. Like this would be kind of fucked up in the best way possible.
Yeah, it's a weird thing with comics because that is where our minds go quite often. As you look at somebody and you think, "Oh man, it'd be great to see them on, you know, Kirby's Fourth World or, you know, something." That's just the tendency, and I do all that all the time as well. Where I look at somebody and think, "Oh man, you know, I mean, like Jonathan, of course, would kill a Swamp Thing book. Yeah. You know, Matt, I mean, anything he would do, but." Yeah, it's remarkable, like you said, the growth just within the last couple of years with what Matt's been doing.
Yeah, it's insane, and you know he's definitely just also an innocent, really awesome person, and like quite a few people, I myself have run out of adjectives to like describe them. It's just, you know, my buddy Brian Lovell, like I literally told him, like, I don't have objectives for your work anymore. I'm just going to like it and retweet it. And that's it. Like, I what else am I going to say that I haven't said already? Like, you know, I don't have there's not a big enough thesaurus in the world.
Yeah.
For an amazing art. And it's,
sure. And, you know, it's shameful, that the industry doesn't recognize people like that, because that's the essence of comics right there. It is all about the art and it is all about mark making. And we don't value that, the way we should. I mean, you and I do, there's a select part of the audience, but the broader comic book audience, doesn't seem to care all that much about art. It seems like sometimes you watch certain YouTube videos of people who are, you know, dedicating their lives to comics, but they talk about comics and they never even mention the art. And Matt should be winning all kinds of awards and making hundreds of thousands of dollars, but
hopefully the comics world sees the light. I think the success of your book will hopefully be just a one step up a bunch more steps for you achieving bigger and better things with your work. I hope it gets to see just a huge audience from this. I hope publishers see this. I hope, you know, whatever success you're hoping for, you know, whoever can help make that happen sees what happens when, you know, a person such as yourself who puts such passion and dedication and just, you know, themselves into their work and the response that happens with that. I hope someone sees that and, you know, says, I got to take this person to the, you know, help take this person to the next level and, you know, all that. So, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for answering all these social media questions.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you, everybody, for asking them. That you guys really turned up and asked a bunch of questions. But they're all great questions. Even the one that was like, why? Because sometimes we just have to sit down and ask why or how or whatever it was.
Yeah. No, you're right. And thank you for saying that. And thank you for having me on. This has been great. And if you do ever have an All Kiss special, I'm definitely signing up for that. So please keep me in mind.
I think I have a decent amount of people who could make that happen. Okay. Kiss round table.
All right.
All right, Matthew, thank you so much. Oh, thank you. I'm sorry. Before we forget, because I already almost forgot, where can people find your work on social media?
Well, here you go. Here's where it gets confusing with the Kankor stuff. On Instagram, I'm at Kankor, but with two R's, Kankorr. Actually, on Twitter, I'm at Matthew G. Allison, but it comes up as Kankor with like five C's and five R's. And then I have a website, kankorcomic.com, which right now basically will just take you to my fundraiser page, which is fundraiser, which is razr.com/kankorbook.
Awesome. Awesome. And as of recording, you are at 190% of your goal.
Amazing.
It says 27 days left, but when this episode posts, there will be 20 days left. So you have plenty of time, though I suggest you waste none of it, to go and contribute and get yourself a copy of the Kankor Collected Edition. Again, for the last time, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. Please be sure to return next episode with my guest, the writer-artist behind Commander Rao and the new Kickstarter book, And We Love You, Bellhound. See you then.